Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Paul Cartledge talking about Herodotus.
So rumour has reached me in the fastness of Cambridge that a certain issue of gender representation has been raised. Now we, of course, know it's not quantity, but quality. And I am perfectly convinced that one woman speaker is worth at least 10 male speakers. Besides, what has not perhaps been widely appreciated, with Jenny Murray, you get 21 for the price of one. I'm going to be talking about Herodotus, who makes 375, not 374, not 376 references to women individually, collectively. Thucydides, whom I'm going to show shortly after an image of Herodotus, makes about 50 references to women collectively, individually, and very grudgingly at that. And those of you who know your Periclean funeral speech as presented by Thucydides will know that he ends it by saying, "If I must turn to address the women in my audience, who are widows, who are perhaps grandmothers of the dead men that I have been celebrating, well, my advice to them is not to sink below their normal nature." So in other words, it's already pretty low. Do not go. And secondly, do not allow yourselves to be talked about, whether for praise or blame, among unrelated men, which is, of course, what he's doing when he's talking about the dead men and to people who weren't related. So it's an extraordinary passage. Herodotus is celebrating his birthday this year. You may be wondering, why am I talking about Herodotus, the father of history, in 2017? Because if you believe he was born in 484 BC or BCE, add 484 to 2017, and you get 2,501. So why is this the 2,500th birthday of Herodotus? Because there was no BC naught or AD naught or BCE naught or CE naught. It's a familiar trap. So this is the, if he was born in 484 BC, BC. We actually don't know when he was born. He didn't write his autobiography. He didn't go on Twitter and tell everybody what he was up to, sharing his latest discovery, his latest story. And the contemporaries of Herodotus were much more interested in men of action, event-making heroes of the kind of, I'm going to show you a couple, Themistocles and Pericles, rather than Herodotus. Yet, I'm going to suggest to you that he is a contemporary, for us, hero. And the reason for me he is a hero is that he is an apostle of toleration, that he treated equally Greeks and non-Greeks. I've already said how many references to women he made. He did not believe that any one group or people's culture was by definition intrinsically, undoubtedly superior to that of every other culture or people. He was religious, but he didn't believe that his religious beliefs should be imposed on others. And he included the religious factor as just one of the factors in his history. He did not think it was the hand of God which decided the way in which the past went. So for all these reasons, he was a pluralist. He was a kind of cultural relativist. He is astonishingly modern, and it is a fact that had I been giving this lecture, let's say, 150 years ago, I would have rubbished him. He's a storyteller. He makes it up. Gibbon famously said, "Herodotus writes sometimes for children," that is, he tells the sort of tales that children like to read, fairy tales, "and sometimes for philosophers," so that's sort of big issues, such as I've been talking about, religion, politics, and so on, "but he doesn't write for historians, In the late 19th century, my discipline became professionalized, disciplinized. Journals were founded, for example, the Journal of Hellenic Studies, 1888, Oscar Wilde on the initial board of the Journal of Hellenic Studies. But Herodotus would then have been ranked well below the man who was considered the founding father of scientific history. And that is, of course, Thucydides. So I'll try to be making a case tonight why you should be tolerant and open-minded and embrace the diversity, plurality, inclusiveness of Herodotus's text, as opposed to the searingly brilliant but narrowly focused narrative and explanation of Thucydides. So, you may or may not be able to read, but down below Tom Holland is another name in very blurred type. So Tom and I between us, and it's mainly Tom, who is of course the brother, the older brother of James Holland, who is the co-founder, co-director of this festival, to whom we owe an immense amount, as indeed I owe to Bryanston School and to Sarah for her overgenerous introduction. Tom Holland learned enough ancient Greek, and Herodotus's Greek, you probably know this, was not standard. He wrote in Ionic Greek, not Attic Greek. So not this one that, for example, if you're a student of later Greek of the Roman imperial period, you'll know that the Greek then is called Koine, common Greek. Well, common Greek is based on Attic Greek, the Attic of Thucydides. Herodotus's Greek is actually quite difficult. Tom spent many, many years learning enough Greek to be able to translate in his inimitable way. My function was partly to correct, partly to observe what he wrote, partly to annotate and to introduce the text of Herodotus. So that you will find, or a version of, in the bookshop, and I hope some of you may consider even buying it if you don't have a copy already. So I just show you, that's the hardback, which is much too expensive, but Penguin, well, you probably know this, the version that Sarah was waving at you is still in print, updated, modified, and sort of made more professionally accurate. It's still in print, so why on earth are they publishing another version in English? Partly because Herodotus is so important, so interesting, it's worth having more than one version from one publisher. And this is what you will see. This is the paperback cover of the English version of that text. So I mentioned that I would be showing you a bust. It's in fact a herm, a janiform herm of Herodotus conjoined at the neck, at the back of the head, with Thucydides. Thucydides here is on the right. This pointer doesn't seem to be working. He's on your right, and Herodotus is on the left with the fuller beard. This is a Roman era janiform herm. By this time, they were classics. The Romans thought of themselves as lineal descendants of the Greeks in cultural terms. They were carrying the torch, carrying the flame on. So these were the Romans' founding fathers in history, as they have, through the Romans, become mine. But my point, the point in showing you this, and here's reverse the other way around, Herodotus now on your right, Thucydides on your left, is that though you can't imagine Thucydides without Herodotus, he begins his narrative where Herodotus ends his. Big tribute. Nevertheless, they look in opposite directions fixedly. They have a different outlook and a different vision of the past. In a way, I think one might say they are both the joint founding fathers of history. And I'm going to come back to what history means, history meant in its original signification, considerably later, when I'm going to show you a few texts of Herodotus, Greek on the left, with an English-facing translation by Tom Holland. So I've titled this The Ancient Greek World, but you probably all realize this. We call the Greeks Greek. The Greeks call themselves Hellenes, and they always have. And the reason we call them Greeks is because the Romans called them Greeks, and the Romans deliberately called them that to diminish them. Yes, there were a particular bunch of Greeks, they're called Graikoi, living in northeast mainland Greece in what's Thessaly, but it's as if one were to refer to the United States as Delaware, which is, I think, probably the smallest of the 50 states of the American Union. So it's really diminishing, and the Romans have handed that on to us. So what you should really think when you see this image is Hellas. And Hellas is a concept something like Christendom in the Middle Ages, or the Arab world today. It's a cultural circle. It's not a political concept of a state. So there was no single Greek state. There were actually about 1,000 Greek states. And apart from showing you where they all were, and the ones that we're going to be focusing on lived around the Aegean, around the Black Sea, the eastern half of the Hellas. Reason for showing you this is that only 32 or 33 out of the 700 or so Greek political entities in that Aegean Greek world, only 32 or 33 actually could agree with each other long enough, that is for two whole years running, to resist the Persian invasion, the mightiest invasion, the biggest amphibious invasion before D-Day in June 1944. Absolutely vast, but, well, why were they so fissile? One reason, well, the Persians are bound to win. It would be foolhardy to resist. We're going to be rolled over. Let's at least get in with the victors. Another reason, which is rather less admirable, neighbours. Suppose your neighbour declared for the Persians openly, I want the Persians to win. I want to be on the winning side. Well, you might say, I so dislike you, my neighbour, that I'm going to resist the Persian invasion. And Herodotus actually tells us that that is what happened with the people of Phocis, which is somewhere in central Greece, mainland Greece, above the Corinth Gulf, and the neighbouring Thessalians, who had gone over to the Persian side. So, Greece is not a unified political concept. There was Hellas, a cultural concept within which there were 1,000 separate political entities, something like 700 of them in the Aegean, of which a mere 32 or 33 actually united. And it's hugely to the credit of Herodotus, the historian of this mega conflict. He didn't disguise Greek differences. He didn't disguise the paltry showing, in some senses, of Greeks in resistance. There's no upsurge of unified patriotic resistance in mainland Greece. Compare, contrast. Someone asked me, I gave a little talk earlier to schools, and they said, what about the differences or the similarities between Egyptian and Babylonian and Persian historiography, to which I had to say is there was no such thing. Rulers in those countries, they were typically autocrats, single rulers, not responsible, not ruling in republics. They had no responsibility to any but their supporters. They ruled by might, by force. They simply issued propaganda documents, not to be contradicted, or the person might be executed. So Herodotus is the denial of official propaganda. He was not the Greeks' official spokesman writing up, we are the victors, this is how it was, aren't we fantastic? Not at all. He gives you the rough as well as the smooth. I needn't, I think, dwell on many of the cities here, but I'm going to just point out at the bottom Sparta, which was the most important resisting city, because it brought with it something like 15 or 16 of those 32 or 33. And the other most important city was Athens, because it brought the navy. And the Persian invasion, 484-79, was amphibious by land and by sea, and the Persians had to be met at every junction by a united force, united in the sense of land forces uniting with naval forces. This is focusing in more closely on the Aegean specifically, and that's to give you a sense. I'm going to show you another map which is of the same tendency. Concentrate on the pink bits here, because this is the world in which Herodotus lived, as opposed to the world that he wrote about, that he talked about, that he delivered his original orations about. And if you can read at the top, it's the Athenian Empire at its height, about 450 BC. Athens and Sparta jointly resisted and successfully the Persian invasion. There were four major battles, two by land, two by sea, and the Greeks lost one of them and won the other three, which was the crucial thing. The Athenians picked up the torch which the Spartans put down after resisting, repelling the Persians. And the Athenians formed an alliance which had three major objects. One, to free such Greek cities as still were in the Persian Empire, even after the repelling of the Persian navy and army in 479. And this is perhaps the point, I don't know if you can see it, but towards the bottom of the map on the right, that's where Herodotus is from, Halicarnassus, which is today Bodrum. Many of you who are windsurfers will, of course, know Bodrum intimately. But he was born a subject of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire extended up to the border, the western border, what's today Turkey, the Asia continent. The Persians claimed Asia as theirs. So anybody living within it who was not Persian ethnic and was refusing to be subject to them was a potential enemy. So the Athenians, by promoting the liberation of Greeks who'd been living in that part of the world for hundreds of years before the Persian Empire arose in the 6th century BC, they formed a tributary and ship-contributing alliance. We call it an empire, but it was pathetic by comparison with the Persian Empire, or later the Chinese Empire, or even the British or the Roman Empire. We call it an empire, but actually it lasted only 60, 70 years. It had something like 200 members. They contributed either ships or money, but nevertheless, it's relatively small scale. It didn't generate its own internal institutions, such as the Roman Empire generated Roman citizenship. So that is the world of Herodotus. He would have gone to Athens, which was the main anti-Persian state, holding aloft the banner of Greek freedom. And one of the themes, very crucial theme, running all the way through Herodotus, is freedom, and especially freedom of the Greeks from Persia. But let me just remind you, Sparta down here controlled more or less the bottom half of the Peloponnese. Who do you think did the agricultural work there? It wasn't the Spartans. It was the Helots, who were Greek. They spoke Greek. They worshipped the same gods as the Spartans. They'd been there before the Spartans, but they were slaves, in effect. They were serfs. So freedom, which the Spartans achieved by defeating the Persian invasion, did not mean freedom for the Helots of Sparta. So it's just a very complicated picture. Herodotus, to his great credit, again, mentions a major revolt that the Helots led in the 460s. So you get a total picture, even though Herodotus is mainly concentrating down to 479 BC. He's not interested as such in what happened after 479 BC. That, I think, most clearly of all, it's a very modern map in terms of color coding, indicates to you the Athenian Empire's reach and indeed the subdivisions for tributary purposes within which the allies were divided up. So I pass on to a rather different geographical space. The Greek word for the universe is cosmos. Some of you, I dare say, possibly occasionally, use cosmetics. Now, you may not realize that the same root applies to both. Why did the Greeks call the universe the cosmos? Because they saw it as an orderly whole with an inner logic, as it were. Why did they think cosmetics adorn and make people beautiful? Because they liked harmony, symmetry, proportion, and cosmetics are a way of emphasizing such aspects of especially the human face, but also other parts of the body. So cosmos, cosmetics. But I show you that mainly for two reasons, not the etymological one. One is, though Herodotus was a global historian, he's in a way the father of global history, his notion of what the globe was pathetically restricted by comparison with ours. We have satellite photos from space. We've actually seen the entirety of the Earth from space and so on. They had no notion. And some of you may know this already, but you may notice there's no British Isles there. Oh my goodness, how could he possibly have omitted them? Because it wasn't until 100 years after Herodotus that a bold and brave man from Massalia, which is modern Marseille, sailed south, then he turned east, and he went out through the Straits of Gibraltar and turned right. Instead of going to Africa, he went up the Atlantic, past France, up to Britain. And so he is the Columbus of the ancient world, just as Columbus discovered America, Pythias of Marseille discovered the British Isles. So, very much restricted by our standards. Now, I show you that one. It's a version of the same thing, so that you get a sense of how big Asia is, the Persian Empire. What on earth was in Darius's mind, Xerxes' mind, mounting this massive invasion to get hold of piddling Greece in the middle, which, of course, this is from a Hellenocentric point of view. Greece is the center of the universe. But what on earth was in it for the Persians? And it is a question, and there is a question mark. And I think part of the explanation, it's very much the same as why did Julius Caesar land in Britain in 55 BC and 54 BC? Partly to show the flag, in other words, to tell the world, in Julius Caesar's case, that there were no limits to the Roman Empire. But secondly, there is a kind of pragmatic reason. Greeks in the 490s had aided and abetted a bit of a rebellion against the Persian emperor, the Persian great king. And what first Darius and then his son Xerxes wanted to do was punish the pesky Athenians. Do not interfere in my sphere, which is Asia. But between Darius, 490, Battle of Marathon, and 480, the stakes had been raised. No longer punitive, but actually conquest was in the mind of Xerxes. So the defeat of Xerxes was much more devastating for Persia, much more irritating and humiliating than was the defeat at Marathon, even though, well, there isn't a single mention in any Persian record, not that we've got many of a historical kind, of what was going on in Greece at this time at all. I mentioned the Battle of Marathon, 490 BC. You may or may not be able to see Greek letters inscribed along the bottom of the cheek piece of this hoplite helmet, which has seen better days. It's actually in the museum at Olympia because it was dedicated by relatives of the great Miltiades, who had been the principal strategist of the Athenians' victory at the Battle of Marathon, which has given its name to our marathon race for probably very spurious historical reasons, but nevertheless. Much more substantial and relevant to Herodotus' story as well as to ours is this, again, a remnant of a victory dedication. In a way, Miltiades' helmet was a victory dedication to Zeus at Olympia, Zeus of Mount Olympus, which is why Olympia is called Olympia. This is a dedication to Apollo at Delphi. And so I can hear you say, if it's a dedication to Apollo at Delphi, why is it in the old Hippodrome, in what was Byzantium, which became Constantinople, which is today Istanbul, about which my dear friend Bettany will be talking to you later this week? Well, the answer is Constantine, who founded the new Rome, Constantinopolis, city of Constantine, in the early 4th century AD, he wanted some legitimating evidence that he was pursuing the good old days. He was in the line of the Greeks who defeated the pesky Persians, because the big enemy of Byzantium was, at this time, as I'm sure you know, the Sassanians. And therefore, anything reminding Greeks of the glory days of the past when they smashed the Persians, this is all very good. So, at his new Rome, he erects this bronze pillar with, at the top, originally, three snakes' heads and a golden bowl resting on the three snakes' heads. But I'm interested more in the names. I said earlier, only 32 or 33 Greek cities and peoples conspired to resist the Persians when they invaded in 480, 479. Here they are. And at the very top, rather disfigured by time, Sparta. They called themselves Lacedaemonioi, from Lacedaemon, the official name of Sparta and the Spartan state. Below them, Athanaioi, that's the Athenians, in the local Delphic script. Not Athenaioi, but Athanaioi. Below them, Corinthioi, major role at the Battle of Salamis. Spartans were the key players at the Battle of Plataea. The Athenians were the key players at the Battle of Salamis. So you have the three great victors. Battle of Thermopylae, which was the first battle, though the Greeks somehow managed to persuade themselves that it was a sort of victory, was actually a major defeat at the time. But that's history, as we say. So that's one of the snake's heads. It's the only one that survives from the column. That's rather nice, I think. Gives some idea of the fangs. I put on the screen next an image of Pericles, because this is the age in which Herodotus himself was living and about which he was writing. He was, I think, warning his fellow countrymen, watch out, we'll be facing another terrible catastrophe if you don't get your act together. But he was worried not about Persians invading, but Greeks fighting other Greeks, in particular Sparta fighting Athenians. Pericles also, I put up there, I mentioned his funeral speech. Though he was an aristocrat, incredibly rich, so one of the elite, very smart, well-educated, all that stuff. Nevertheless, he was a convinced radical Democrat. He believed the demos, in the sense of the masses, the poor, the uneducated, the unwashed, the illiterate in some cases, in the mass, should have the final say. So he was a convinced Democrat. Herodotus' own view, slightly difficult to establish. He says sometimes nice things about democracy, sometimes not nice things about democracy. And on the other hand, he does preserve the earliest Western discussion of democracy as a political system. So do, when you get hold of your copy, Book 3, Chapters 80 to 82. Themistocles, the architect of the naval victory at Salamis, a real thug, obviously. And now I'm going to end with just a few passages. I apologize if I've got the timing wrong here, but I think we're okay to have another few minutes. So, on the left you have a Greek version, and just to remind you, Herodotus uttered, he spoke his histories. At some point he will have had to dictate them to a scribe, unless he himself wrote it all out originally. We're in the 420s BC, there's no book market. They're using papyrus rolls, which are exceptionally difficult to read. When you've unrolled them one way, you've got to roll them all back up and start again. So it would have taken many, many rolls. Our word volume comes from the Latin word for a roll of papyrus, volumen. He himself, therefore, was speaking his words of wisdom more often than they were being read. Thucydides, on the other hand, wrote for readers exceptionally difficult, dense prose. Herodotus is limpid and flowing and more or less straightforwardly comprehensible and very economical, actually, as well. So, what I want to draw your attention here to... I think it's working now. No, it goes off. Hang on. Well, it doesn't seem to pick up on the screen. But the second line on the left, historiae, translated on the right, inquiries. We use the word history to refer to the result of inquiry. Historia, in its original signification, meant critical inquiry into the evidence for the past. For Herodotus, mainly oral evidence, what we call tradition. He has to decide. He's not going to be able to revisit the past. He relies on the most reliable, authentic witnesses that he can lay his hands on. And he was, of course, we think, born roughly 480s. So people who are doing things as far back as the 540s, let's say they were born in 560, they would be in the 470s, in their 80s and 90s. There would be one or two of them alive. But the reason he really begins in about 550 is because he couldn't get beyond the generation of his grandfathers or great-grandfathers in any reliable way. So he sets out his stall in his preface. And for me as a historian, there are two things which are most important about this. One is the equal balance between Greeks and, he calls them, barbarians. It means non-Greeks, people who don't speak Greek, who don't practice Greek customs. He's going to celebrate their glory equally with those of the Greeks. This is not a triumphalist, look what we did to you guys, I'm going to rub your nose in the dirt now. Secondly, and it's the final clause, most importantly, his aim was to explain. And it seems to me, though history often relies on storytelling, narrative, and so on, ultimately our most important, though most difficult, function is to try to explain, to pick a path between the rival explanations of the time and since, to illuminate the past, not merely to describe it. This is a passage about the difference in past time. I won't dwell on this, but he goes back as far as the 530s and 520s here. And he says that Polycrates, roughly in the middle there, came from the island of Samos, was the first Greek ever to have done what Herodotus says he does, with the exception of Minos, who may have ruled the seas. The point being, he's certain Polycrates was both real and ruled the seas, whereas Minos is myth, legend, beyond historical recovery. Herodotus, I would beg to differ from him to some degree, believed that it was the Athenians winning the Battle of Salamis that absolutely made the difference between defeat and success. I think he undervalues the final decisive victory, which is the Battle of Plataea the following year, 479. It says here that they were backed by the gods. That's obviously crucial. If they'd not been backed by the gods, then perhaps they wouldn't have won. But he doesn't mean that the gods made the difference, that without them the Greeks couldn't have done anything. This is the passage I started from, really, implicitly. We're talking about what was a Greek. Passage is set historically in a very dark period, the winter between the first campaign, 480, and the last campaign, 479, when the Persians sent a lot of money to try to bribe the Athenians to throw the game, as it were, to desert the Greek alliance. And the Athenians respond, and partly I think because Herodotus thought the Athenians were the principal architects of the Greek, but he puts it in their mouths, a triumphant expression of what the Hellenic spirit was. And Herodotus I admire because, though he's writing of war, he is sometimes called the prose Homer, and Homer, of course, writes or in some sense composes an epic about the Trojan War. I don't think Herodotus actually particularly enjoyed writing about war. And here in the first passage at the top there, he says that civil strife among people of the same heritage, let's say Athens against Sparta, is as much worse than a united war of Greeks, Athens and Sparta, against non-Greeks, as war is worse than peace. So war is terrible. Some versions of it are even worse than others. Down the bottom here, famous passage, the difference between war and peace. In war, fathers bury their sons, that's the unnatural order, whereas in peace, sons bury their fathers, that's the natural order. I think Herodotus quotes this because he likes the sentiment that it expresses. And this is a long passage, I'm going to end with this. He imagines a situation where King Darius of Persia is curious to know what his subjects think about a particular issue, which is funeral customs. So he's in Susa, one of his principal palaces, and he summons some Greeks and he summons some Indians. And the scenario is, it's not actually completely accurate, that Greeks cremate, whereas Indians cannibalize their kindred dead. So he says to the Athenians, and of course bribery and Athenians and Greeks, you know, this is a quite established theme, how much do I have to bribe you to abandon your custom of cremation and adopt the custom of anthropophagy, cannibalism, of the Indians? And the Athenians are appalled. They certainly wouldn't think about it. He then asks the Indians in reverse, how much do I have to bribe you to cremate your dead as opposed to eat them? They are even more shocked than the Athenians at the very notion, which is interesting. Barbarians more shocked at Greeks than Greeks are shocked at barbarians. And then he ends up by saying, I therefore think each group of people, after carefully sifting through the customs of other people, would surely choose their own. In other words, what makes a people, is their customs in common. For example, funerary customs. But does that mean that any one people's customs are superior to any others? Even when one of the peoples is Greek and the other one is non-Greek, no. Because all of us, we humans, are all identical. We construct our cultures through our agreement on such fundamental customs. And so he quotes Pindar, the lyric poet, custom is king of all. And that is the thought that I would like to leave you with. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk. or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.